Hello, and welcome to the Untitled Female Driven Podcast. We are three film and television writers who are here to talk about how to make it as professional writers in the entertainment industry. This podcast covers what we wish we'd known when we were getting started, so you all can learn the easy way what we learned the hard way. I'm Erica Schreiber. I mostly write features.
I'm Jess Cho. I mostly write for television.
And I'm Hannah Rosner. I also mostly write for television. And today we have a very special guest, writer Liz Caron.
Hi!
Liz is the author of Night's Edge, a mother-daughter story set against the backdrop of a pandemic of vampirism. And it's on bookshelves now from publisher Tor Nightfire, with a sequel on the way, slated for release in 2024, which we cannot wait to read. She is also the author of the dark fantasy adventure The Phantom Forest. In addition to her work in literary fiction, Liz is also a screenwriter and award-winning playwright. She's a graduate of the Rita and Burton Goldberg Department of Dramatic Writing at NYU Tisch.
And shut the front door, me too.
I was going to say, wait a minute. So is Erica. We'll get back to that. And has numerous film and TV projects in active development, including an adaptation of Night's Edge for Freeform and 20th Television. Welcome, Liz.
Hi.
So happy to have you, Hannah.
Erica, what year did you graduate from dramatic writing?
2006.
Okay, so I graduated in like 2008 and a half because I was a transfer. I arrived in the fall of 2005.
Maybe I saw you on the elevator or in, you know, like in the department, which is not very big.
You probably saw me napping on the futons in the lobby of the seventh floor, honestly, if you saw me anywhere. So, you know.
That was a very popular napping place. Wow, so funny. I had no idea. I like devoured your book.
Me too.
Hannah kept getting texts from me being like, I'm so concerned. Just loved it.
I got your book at Skylight Books, which is my local and / favorite bookstore. And unfortunately, I missed your author's panel there.
Oh, it was awesome. They ran out of chairs. We love to see it.
Love that. Yeah. Standing room only.
It was. I was shocked. I was like, there were all these intersections of different friend groups and also people I didn't know who I didn't know each other. Like, LA is the craziest place. It is such a small world, which is why you have to be nice to everyone.
Right.
All the time. But it was so fun. My conversation partner was Bria Grant, who is a filmmaker as well, directs a lot of horror films. And she also hosts a podcast called Reading Glasses, which you should all check out. So she had read the book and reviewed it on her podcast. She and I know each other from back in the day. And we decided to like have a conversation at Skylight about it. And it was so fun.
That's awesome. Take us back to the beginning. We always like to start with origin stories on the podcast, and we would love to hear yours.
So, I mean, I have been writing for truly as long as I can remember, which sounds really pretentious and cheesy, but like it is true. When I was super little, my mom would type out the stories I would dictate to her, and she'd print them in little storybooks, and then I would illustrate them when I was like 4 or 5 years old. And then I started acting when I was living in the Chicago area. First of all, I moved a bunch when I was little. I was born in the Bay Area, then lived in Connecticut for a little while. And then when I was like 6 years old, we moved to the Chicago area where I lived for the rest of like my elementary school years and got really into theater when I was there. And I did tons of musicals, and I thought I was going to just go hard and go to Broadway and never come home. That was my obsession for many years. But by the time I got to high school, I started realizing I was a much better writer than I was actor, and I was much happier not being on stage. I also couldn't dance, which is a tangent, and like, you know, so you can't go to Broadway if you're not a triple threat. So I like wrapped my head around that.
Whether or not someone can dance is entirely subjective.
That's kind of you to say, but you've never seen me dance, so
that's true. We'll have to make that happen.
Don't speak too soon. And then went to NYU for dramatic writing and realized I wanted to write plays and films and got into television as well when I was there. Kind of had a strange journey getting into writing professionally because I feel like, you know, I had some features that I wrote early on in my career that got me signed with an agent that like have been in development for like 5 million years, you know, that whole racket, you know, and got me work, got me rewrites and all that wonderful stuff. Joined the guild. Yay. And then you know, but it was just kind of stagnant and I was really having trouble getting staffed. I would always get the showrunner meeting and I would get really far and then I wouldn't get the job. And I was like, why? I don't know why. So I kind of just let that rest for a bit. And then in the meantime, I was writing my first book, The Phantom Forest, and just like fell in love with writing books because I hadn't written prose since I was younger and just remembered how much I, you know, how happy I was kind of luxuriating in language like that again. So did that. Felt really good. Did another one. And now we're here.
Nice. Love that.
I was curious how you guys met, Hannah and Liz.
Our mutual friend Emmy put us in touch last year around this time. And I believe the way that she described Liz was, yeah, she's like a TV writer and, you know, was trying to staff and just decided to start writing books. And now they're making TV shows out of her books. And I was like, well, I need to meet this person. It's awesome.
And we love Emmy. We go way back. So like she, you know, I'm like, any friend of hers is a friend of mine. Let's hang out. We had like a delightful first drinks together where we talked about so many weird things. And I was like, we're going to be buddies. I love this girl.
Yeah. And so you said you were writing prose like when you were younger and then you got back into writing books with The Phantom Forest. Were you always writing short stories in between or did you really like take a pause?
Yeah. So I hadn't written a short story since like high school. I had written a bunch of them in my creative writing class like senior year that I really loved. And I think one of them was even in my, you know, portfolio when I applied to colleges and what have you. But then I just was so interested in film and screenwriting that I just, you know, wanted to be on set. I wanted to learn about directing and producing as well. Like I went all in on that and I was still writing plays. I was still doing theater at the time. So yeah, I think they're just, it felt a little crowded in my brain for a couple of years. And so I wasn't writing short stories or anything like that anymore. And then there was this one, oh, actually, no, I take that back. There was my freshman year of college, and nobody will ever read this book, but I wrote this, like, this really strange, horny book about ancient Egypt that, like, it was borderline erotica. My reasons for writing it, unclear. I think I was lonely. I don't know. It was a weird time for me.
Liz, you come to the right place.
Yeah. And then The Phantom Forest, which I wrote in 2011, was really, yeah, I just, like you said, I just decided to dive back into writing prose with a novel. And it was not easy. Like, I think that my first draft of Phantom Forest, which was a novel I wanted to take seriously and wanted to try to publish, you know, my first draft, it was very sparse because when we're writing, you know, television and film, you know, being sparse is the name of the game, as much white space on your page as possible, you know, and then you have to hit your act breaks and everything in television. If you have act breaks, it's really regimented. And when you're writing a novel, you're like, let's sit here for a moment. Let's talk about how this feels in her body. Let's describe this landscape. Let's describe how this book smells. So you can really just, like, I think I used the word luxuriate before, and I will use it again because that's what it feels like. And it's after a long time, you know, of doing screenwriting and creating in this very sparse environment, it was really wonderful to come back to a medium that allowed me some breathing room.
Yeah. Do you feel like you get better in touch with your characters having that sort of space to really just live in those, you know, those small moments?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is something that made writing Night's Edge really a singular, special experience for me, because it's so in Mia's head, the protagonist. Like, you are just so deeply in her POV and in her memories that, you know, it changed the way I develop characters. But what this did was create unintentional roadblocks when I went to start adapting it, which I know we're going to talk about, because it's so interior. The first issue we encountered was, oh no, how do we internalize all of this?
There's something weirdly freeing about a limited perspective, that there are things that the reader is figuring out that you really want her to realize, you know, about her mother, about herself, et cetera, et cetera. and that kind of tension between what she knows and what she's actually saying, like what we can see. I just thought that was so well done in the book, like just a fangirl at you for a second. But
thank you.
Actually, I just found it on my phone because I took a picture of a line from the book that it like made me gasp. It was so good and so real and really spoke to me. And I want to use this as a jumping off point to talk about Night's Edge and how you develop the idea and all that. But the line was, let's see, I don't think I could keep myself from telling the truth, even if it wasn't a true story. The secrets of my life would seep between the lines and bleed all over the page. I mean, I audibly gasped when I read this because I was like, this is how I feel when I write. I feel so exposed and I feel so like I'm just literally bleeding on the page. And then but it's like, that is how you get the best writing, when you're really writing from the heart or using either not even necessarily like personal experience, like this exactly happened to me, but just like sort of that genuine emotion of something you've experienced finding its way into a character or into a story. So yeah, I'd love to hear just what inspired you to write this book, because it started as a short story, right?
Yeah, it did. One of my mantras for writing is like, don't write what you know, write what emotions you know, which are, you know, people misinterpret what write what you know. And it, to me, it all boils down to what are the feelings that are just like imprinted upon your gut that you take with you everywhere. That's what you need to write about. And you can kind of superimpose them upon all sorts of dramatic situations in different characters. So in this particular setup, it is vampires, and we're using them to talk about codependency and addiction and illness and abusive relationships, which, you know, vampirism is a great window into all of those ideas, because it's by nature an extremely, you know, parasitic mythology, right? So I knew for a long time I wanted to write something that had to do with, you know, parents and children, parentification, which is the concept of children having to step into a parenting role for their parents. And usually it comes about due to an illness or addiction or, you know, any financial struggles. It can come about for a whole host of different reasons, but it is something I experienced growing up. And I think that, you know, especially what Mia sees her mother go through when Mia's only 10 years old, this completely insane, supernatural, gruesome illness, that is also something that I experienced as a child with my parent, seeing them go through something so horrific and me convincing myself that there was something I could do to stop it or to keep it from happening again. And yeah, so as I was getting older and finally, you know, had moved away from home and was just unpacking some things from my childhood, going to therapy, you know, highly recommend it.
we're big fans of therapy on this podcast.
We love therapy. Interestingly enough, I mean, this is a tangent, but I was doing EMDR, which I don't know if anyone's heard of, but it's basically...
I've done that. Anyway,
you've done it? Yeah.
Yes, I have.
it really helped me confront some old memories and process how they felt in my body. And it really helps people with CPTSD and what have you. So I was like a very good candidate for it. If you don't know what it is, look it up. It's kind of weird, but for some people it works beautifully. And that was when I, you know, started coming up with this concept. And so there are things in here that are personal to me. That being said, my mother is not a vampire.
What?
And and there was not some shadowy deviant man who, you know, infected her one night at our house. You know, it's not like, you know, there are things that are not true in this story. This is a work of fiction.
It's got to be tough to navigate like questions about when you're putting a lot of yourself into it, but also fictionalizing so much of it. And then, you know, I assume is there any like anxiety about people drawing the wrong conclusions or just like, how has that been? Because I would have a hard time with it.
It's an interesting question. The phrase I kept repeating to myself this whole past year before the book came out and I knew we were going to be doing promotion and what have you was, this is a work of fiction. This is a work of fiction. This is a work of fiction. If I wanted to write a memoir, I would have done that, but I didn't want to, and I don't think I ever will. So when, and the other thing I have said to certain family members of mine was, I don't think you're the intended audience for this story for a lot of reasons. I don't think they would ever want to read a really violent, scary vampire book that is, you know, about abusive relationships and also very queer. Like, I just don't think that's something they'd be into. So I did tell them that. And then the other thing that, you know, I also have said is, I don't control the things that a reader is going to say about the work. When there are reviews, when there are blurbs, when there's just stuff on social media, I can't control how somebody else describes this or connects with it. So if they see something that unsettles them, that somebody else who is not me has said about it, I don't control that. But yeah, Hannah, to answer your question, it's been something I've had to just prepare for and be okay with. Because the truth of the matter is, like, it is a work of fiction and the emotions in it are real. I deserve to let those emotions be expressed as an artist.
I think that takes a lot of courage and a lot of bravery. And it's awesome that you've cultivated this quite early in your career. Like, obviously you're very accomplished in all the ways that we described already, but you clearly have a long career ahead of you as well as an author. And so I feel like it probably takes...
I hope that's true.
Yeah, I'm sure it takes people many decades to get to that point of like, okay, this is, the work is going to speak for itself. I cannot control how people respond to it. But also the world we live in today, I feel like you hear the 10% of just confusion or misrepresentation and don't get to necessarily be aware of just how many people have been touched by your work or have been moved by it.
Erica, Hannah, and I are all genre writers primarily. And because I think we've all agreed that like genre is a wonderful way to dissect certain issues that are perhaps too painful or just too much to, if you just did it in a straightforward, realistic fiction way. It's like genre is a good platform to talk about these things. And so I was wondering if that was perhaps one of the reasons that like why you chose to write or to dissect these emotions in this way, using genre, and what is your feeling about genre in general?
Oh yeah, I think, you know, you took the words right out of my mouth, that is how we unpack certain emotions and complicated situations in our world. You know, we've been using genre to confront that for, you know, hundreds of years. We have mythology, you know, going back centuries. So yeah, I feel like genre provides this really nice like umbrella between us and our real world experiences. We don't have to stare directly into the sun, no pun intended.
So if the umbrella was also like a magnifying glass somehow.
Yeah. What is this instrument that I'm describing? It's very contradictory, very weird.
I wanted to talk to you about genre as well and talk to you a little bit about how you approach world building, just sort of mythology, and because you've worked in this space, but not in the same, you know, you wrote a vampire novel before that, you wrote a dark fantasy novel, and before that, some erotic ancient civilizations that we must read. We need to find this out.
Yeah, but, you know, I regret absolutely revealing this to you.
Do not. You've created like whole worlds. And one thing to mention about Night's Edge, for those who have not read it, is the word vampire is never used in the book. It's called Saratov's syndrome, right? Is that, am I pronouncing it right?
Saratov's syndrome, and the vampires are called Saras, yeah.
And so you have written now a vampire novel, but you have your own unique rules that are unique to this world. You borrow some aspects from traditional vampire lore, but then others you've invented in a really clever way. And then with The Phantom Forest, which I read and loved, that had a ton of world building. I mean, that would be a epic but very expensive show.
No one's paying for that one, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, what can you tell us a little bit about like how you approach world building, building mythology and things like that?
Night's Edge in particular, it was important to me that it felt incredibly grounded and that Mia and her mom, Izzy, could be people who live down the street from you. And that it's baked into the world they live in. And I wrote the short story Night's Edge is based on in like early 2020, before the pandemic was really a thing yet. And then during, during the course of writing that short, the pandemic became a thing. And so when I set out to write the full-length novel, one of the things that got really fleshed out was the pandemic they were dealing with and how it was being spread and all the misinformation on the internet and how you couldn't trust your neighbor to protect against it correctly and like all this stuff that we were dealing with day to day.
And the curfew stuff. I loved that. That really, I was like, oh my God, this feels so 2020, 2021.
Yeah, those parallels were one of my favorite parts, especially the way that they opened the world back up before they had everything in place to make the world safe. I feel that so hard with what's the parallel to our world and how I have people in my life who still can't go out in the world because we've all just decided that it's fine, you know, but it's not. And I loved that, that like, you're like, there's this present danger of like, you can't tell until it's too late whether someone's going to infect you. And I was like, yes, so true.
Yeah. And the thing about the scanners in Night's Edge was directly inspired by like having to get my temperature taken every time I walked into a restaurant or a clothing store or like any indoor establishment that wasn't my house. And I was like, oh, interesting. So, you know, in Night's Edge, you have a panel on each door of each business where you have to press your finger against it and it takes a pinprick of your blood. And it's kind of like Theranos, if Theranos worked.
You know? It's like, ding, but ding, also ding. How easy it is for Mia's mom to get around it. Such a flawed system when the people implementing the system are not using it. Also felt very real to me.
Oh, yeah. She owns the restaurant. And so she has her own private entrance. And no one's ever thought to question her.
No, right? The fact that she owned the business before the vampirism started just made people assume that it was fine. And that's such a like a human thing to just take whatever you can and decide it's fine instead of looking at anything closely. Like I just loved that.
Thank you. It's so interesting because maybe 5-6 years ago, anything you'd write about a pandemic or like anything that was slightly dystopian, it always felt heightened. It was always really hard to make it feel grounded as hard, you know, as much as you might try. But now we've lived it. So it doesn't feel so fictional anymore. There's not as much separation.
Things that you probably would have had an editor to say like, no, people would never behave this way. That doesn't get said anymore because we've seen the breadth of human behavior in a pandemic. And it really astonished a lot of us as, you know, truth being stranger than fiction that we can now use for our fiction.
Yeah. Another thing during the pandemic that, and also the election during 2020, just all the misinformation on social media and all the crazy things people would say, like, this is how you cure it. And this is what you do. And all the little like communities that would spring up on Facebook and on Twitter. And so like in Night's Edge, there's literally a Facebook group where the Saras can gather and like, you know, anonymously share tips for survival with each other.
Something I wanted to hear a little more about was your also career as a TV writer, right? And you talked a little bit about how, you know, like making it as far as the showrunner meeting. And I've had this experience as well coming from the feature side that it is, at least for me, easier to develop TV, like sell a show or bring on a showrunner to an unproduced project than actually get staffed. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, my experience in TV has been all development. This is my second pilot that I've been brought in to write and develop. There was another one a couple of years ago that was my first that didn't go anywhere. I don't know what it is about the staffing pipeline. I also never did writer's assistant jobs, mainly because I was already working in features and that was kind of my job. And it just didn't really, I had some interviews and it would like sometimes be the right fit, but sometimes it wasn't. Yeah. And it just kind of, it's one of those things in life that just didn't happen. So a lot of my really good friends who have gotten staffed over the years rose up through the ranks and got promoted from those support staff jobs. But also a lot of people haven't, which is, you know, another.
Yeah, that pipeline is so much more broken than it used to be.
Incredibly flawed. There are no guarantees. Yeah, I don't know what to say about the staffing thing, only that, like, I know how to write. I know I'm here for a good reason, but it just didn't happen. What can I say?
It's interesting, right? Just being in the same boat of like you're developing a show and you're working with the network creatively, and you know that like when it comes to the actual writer's room, I also don't have the same experience as Hannah and Jess of like the actual workings of a writer's room. I've worked as a writer's assistant and even in like as a combo writer's assistant staff writer, but that was in a mini room that felt very different from the like standard bread and butter. And it's always funny to me to be like, yeah, you want my show, but you know that I can't run the room, right, guys? And just that uncertainty while at the same time creatively contributing in a really serious way is just a really odd place to be.
Absolutely.
Not uncommon right now.
You can spend so much time working yourself into a tizzy wondering, why didn't they hire me? Was it this? Was it because I don't have this experience? Is it because of my script? Was blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, I've been through it. I know a lot of people who have been through it. And it's just kind of a waste of energy because at the end of the day, you have no idea what the showrunner is looking for, what is factoring into their decisions about hiring. And It's a tough thing. But as far as getting into the adaptation of Knight's Edge, how did that come about in terms of long before the book was even published, you got interest in, you know, developing it into a series. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
You know, so I had finished writing the book, and so I've been at Verve for books, television, and features for a few years now. And so it was sold by my awesome book agent at Verve, Liz Parker. She is another Liz. She's allowed to Liz. And she was wonderful. And that was February 2021. And then I had this discussion with my whole team about what my ideal situation for an adaptation would be. And I said, well, it's definitely TV. And I want to work with like a female mentor who can, you know, show me the ropes, but I do want to write. I want to crack at this pilot script. I don't want to just sell the rights to this and not be involved. And I'm not going to engage in a conversation with a producer who doesn't share that sentiment.
Hell yeah. Good for you.
So that narrowed our list down a lot. And they were, you know, but they supported it. And that's what I thought was really, really cool. They were just like, yeah, all right. That, I mean, it makes the list shorter, but, you know, let's go.
Sometimes that's not the worst thing to have a narrow, specific list.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. From what I understand, this only went out to one producer, and that was Jack Schaefer, who had just signed an overall at 20th, and we have the same agent, so it was an easy connection to make. So when people ask, like, how'd this even happen? I'm like, because, I mean, that's Hollywood. Sometimes you have the same agent as someone you really look up to, and, you know, there's a connection there. So that is how she got the book so early. And her assistant at the time, Laura Monti, who is also a TV writer, and she's wonderful. I just saw her the other night at Skylight. She was the one who read it first, and then she gave it to Jack, and she was like, read this right now. And then a week later, or something like that, we had gotten it all buttoned up, and we were working together. So that was how that happened. And then she brought it into 20th, and they liked it a lot, and they said yes. We developed a pitch for literally like almost a year.
Wow.
And that was wild. After lots and lots of practice and lots of me rewriting this pitch and learning how to pitch better with each round, because I thought I knew how to pitch, but oh, wow. You don't know how to pitch until you're pitching with a studio for a network, with other like auspices attached. It is like, okay, wait, I don't actually know what I'm doing. And I thought I did. So I rewrote it like 79 times. And so yeah, fully a year later. So it was March of 2022 at that point, sold it to Freeform. We'd only done two pitches. We did Hulu one day and Freeform the next, and Freeform bought it in the room. Everything that has happened on this project has been shocking to me that could happen.
That's incredible.
You know, so that was pretty cool. And, you know, so ever since then, I've been writing a script and it's had a lot of twisty turns and a lot of different people involved. And also, you know, we just had a huge round of layoffs, unfortunately, at Disney. And now, of course, we're on strike. So the future is unclear, but there is a script, you know, all the steps were accomplished. At the end of the writing process, they hired a showrunner. So Kedo Shimizu is coming in and doing this with me, which she's wonderful.
I know her tangentially. She was very kind to me during the ATA action when showrunners were reading people.
Oh,
and I
cool.
had such a great experience with her. She was really just sweet and read quickly and shouted it out and has been, like, even in a minor way, like a really great advocate.
Like, I knew some people who had worked for her in the past and all of them were like, she is a great mentor and promotes from within and just, like, you know, everything you want to hear about someone in that position. So I feel really lucky to have her and Jack and, you know, Leslie Headland's involved too with the directing side of things. And I've just, I don't know, there's a lot of really powerful, special women involved with this. So no matter what happens, no matter what the fate of it is, I'm just so glad I got to know all these people because I really look up to them and I've learned a lot.
At the end of the day, you have ownership over the material, the original material as well. So I believe and hope for the best outcome at the end of the strike, which, you know, I hope for the best with the strike in many, many ways. But all that is to say, it's very cool that at the end of all of this, there's no chance that you will have done all this work and, you know, which happens a lot with TV development. If you don't own the rights to the material, it's like you can put so much of your time and effort into something and hope that it gets sold or gets made. You wrote the book. So like you've got a sequel coming out next year. And so it's pretty cool to just like have so much creative control and be so well positioned. So congratulations. It's awesome.
You know, it's interesting though, because like I have been on the other side of that table before. I've been adapting someone else's work and, you know, not had the project get greenlit. So then I would have to say goodbye to everything I'd invested in the project. And that was one of the reasons I realized if I love writing books and if I'm not bad at it, I should keep doing it because it's a really great way to explore an idea in a character that might be harder to do on screen. So B, there's only one name on a book when it comes out and it's yours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not for nothing. And like, then you are the rights holder. You control the IP. You know, that's pretty special. And I will say, not to say, there's a hack for the system, but like, I don't know, it sort of feels a little like a hack.
Yeah, it's not, I can't call it a hack because it's not easy, but it is a way, right? Like, it's a way to have more control, like whether it's, and this is something that we definitely have talked about on this podcast of how to have more of a foothold in your own work, whether it's being a producer on something and fighting your way through that, or in this case, being the owner of the IP because you created the IP. Like, these are all things I think that up-and-coming writers should keep in mind. It's not always possible, and a lot of people don't want to produce, or a lot of people don't feel like they're novelists, but there are ways, and this is a really good one.
Another thing I actually really would like to point out, if anybody is listening to this who are, you know, aspiring authors as well as screenwriters who might find themselves in the same position as me at some point, be really careful about, you know, the deal that you sign, because you want that EP credit. Like, you need to make sure that you're buttoned up and you get everything you can. It's tougher if you are not the one writing the pilot. So I would highly recommend at least trying to get the first draft of it, because that will help you. I know a number of novelists personally who have had shows go that are successful, and they were left out in the cold because of credits.
Yeah, there was something recently, the Sex and the City writer, talking about how she has made almost nothing off of this incredible show that has, you know, 30 years of legs. And of course, the Mean Girls author, same thing. It's now a musical, and they wouldn't, and she makes nothing off of that.
Some bullshit.
There's some bullshit. You gotta like really, really make sure.
Read the fine print.
You gotta really have a team that has your best interests at heart.
I wanna ask, just out of curiosity, personally, and for any of our listeners that, like me, seem to struggle to just put the butt in the chair and get to work. Just like, what's your general day-to-day when you're writing, when you're working on a novel? What's your schedule?
I often like to get up really early to do pages.
Oh, no, not another. Yeah. No. That's awesome. Me and Jess. There's a war on this podcast.
Not enough. Okay, but the second half of that statement is this. I will write as much as I can between the hours of like 6:30 and 8:30 before anybody else in my house is up, and it's just my dog. And because she was, you know, she's a puppy, and so I had to like potty train her and let her out, and it was always me who got up first. So that's like, okay, I want to do my work when it's just quiet and it's just me and this puppy. And so that was what I was doing. And then after like 8:30 or 9, I would run all my errands and go work out and take the dog to the park, make lunch, like do all the things I needed to do. And then around like 4 or 5 o'clock, then I would sit back down, have like a glass of wine, and then I would finish whatever section I had started that morning. And, you know, so you break it up into two sessions. And my rule is 500 words a day, which is not crazy, but also not nothing. And so to me, that was the chunk that felt manageable. Some days it's me highlighting the word count every 10 minutes, being like, now how much do I have? Oh God, now how much? And then some days it just really, you know, you turn the faucet on and it's flowing and you suddenly get 2,000 words. And that's great, but that, you know, you still have to go sit back down tomorrow. It can be difficult, and I'm not strict about this schedule either. If there's a day I sleep too late, then I didn't do morning pages. It's fine. It's not religious. You have to have a life.
I love that. I love the advice too of just like set a minimum 500 words, because that is, I wouldn't say it, oh, that's not that much, but you know, it's manageable. Like it is, anyone can do that if you just block out some time in your schedule to commit to that. And what I found, and I think Erica and I have talked about this too, like on the picket line, or maybe you're just over this podcast, is how if you're just like not feeling it that day, but you know you got to do it, just get started and just be like, I'm just going to write for, you know, for me, I do like time limits, like instead of page count, like, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And then literally just getting my ass in the chair for 20 minutes takes so much effort and focus and like tuning out distractions. But then once I start, 3-4 hours can go by and I don't even know. And all of a sudden my bladder is screaming at me. So sit down and just try to do the bare minimum. You might surprise yourself.
Another thing I love is doing study hall, which is what my friends and I, who are all writers, we call when we go to a bar and we do an early happy hour. So like there are some that start at like 3 or 4 o'clock and we catch up for like a half an hour. We grab a drink. And then we each put on our headphones and we sit across from each other and we write for an hour and then we order another drink and then we talk for a little bit. And then sometimes we help each other with a story problem and then we write for another hour. So that's another fun way to do it. Like my butt's in the chair because her butt's in the chair.
I love
that.
Yeah,
you know, I've never done that with happy hour. I've done that with coffee, but I like happy hour.
No, because then, yeah, the reward is you get wine.
Like, yeah.
Gotta have a reward.
But yeah, in case like y'all live across town like I do, I'm spread out.
Not everyone's a valley dweller. But I think the thing that I like about both, you know, Hannah and, you know, your thing about a time limit and Liz, yours about 500 words, is it really encourages you to be not precious. And I think that's a place where a lot of people get hung up. It's like sometimes it's really not about the quality. It is about the quantity, because you can figure, sometimes you have to write the bad version in order to write the good version. And that's the method that encourages it. You literally just need to put those words on the page, if only so you can delete them. Be like, nope, that's not it. Because that is progress, even if it doesn't feel like.
That leads me to my next question. I have a sense now of, you know, your schedule, but what is your rewriting process? Like, versus, because, you know, everyone has a different way of doing it. There's the version of just get it out, just write the zombie draft or whatever, write the vomit draft, and, you know, don't worry about being precious, just try to get your page count and then go back and fine tune it. And then there's also the like camp of trying to get it right the first time, which I tend to be more in because I'm a perfectionist. But I'm curious, like, do you just try to write as much as you can and then go back and rewrite? Or like, how do you approach rewriting and revising or polishing or whatnot?
Yeah, it really depends. Like, so there's often one version that is just for me that no one will see. And when it's a book, I kill some trees. I do go print it out when it's done. I do kill trees. I only do it this once though. And then I go page by page with a red pen and I read it. And there's something about reading it in a different format, like this tactile response that your brain has, and things jump out at me and I will just attack it. And then I'll go back into the draft. Again, this is mostly the method with books, but I have done this with the pilot too, where I will then go page by page and look at all my notes and transfer all those notes into the draft. And some of them are huge. Some of them are like giant X's through multiple pages being like, none of this, kill this character, we don't need him. So like, you know, it's not as simple as editing the grammar or word choice, but you get through it. And it's shockingly, it is for me anyway, faster to get through an edit than it is to write that first draft, even though I have to think harder. And then by the time it gets to my editor, she will, you know, read it and give me a letter full of macro notes. And then she'll go through the manuscript and leave me comments for things to address. And I go through it again, but this time I don't print it.
Some trees get to live.
Yeah, a few trees get to live. And then one last thing I do, I turn all the font to something really, really ugly, like Comic Sans, and then things jump out at you when
that's
you change
genius.
The font.
I love that.
Wow. I can't believe I never thought of that. Because that's why I will print, that's why I'll print to rewrite, is to read it. It's like somehow it gives me a different look at it. But the font thing is genius. I'm going to try that.
I got it from another writer. I cannot take credit for this. But like, if the writing is good, it will withstand the disgusting font. So.
Well, before we wrap this up, and I know you did give a very helpful piece of advice to authors and young writers starting out earlier, you know, very helpful practical advice about remaining in control of your work and having a good team and all that. But on a more, I guess, personal level, do you have any advice for, you know, because this podcast, a big part of it is, you know, things we wish we had known when we were getting started, things we wish we could tell our younger selves. Do you have any advice for either your younger self or anything you wish you had known when you were getting started?
That it's not a straight line, and that it's going to look more like a tangled nest than an incline. and that the highs are not as high as you think they are, but the lows are not as low as you think they are. That you're always closer to being steady than you think. Because I have experienced a lot of emotion attached to the highs and lows of my career, where, you know, getting rewritten feels like the end of the freaking world, and or getting my book deal felt like, you know, as happy as my wedding day, you know, and I'm like, those highs and lows, you got to learn to manage them or you're not going to survive. So that would be the advice I give my younger self.
That's great. Can you tell us anything about the sequel to Night's Edge?
Yes.
Even if only the title, we just want to know whatever we can to get, tell people to keep their eye on it, put it on their Goodreads list for next year.
Yeah. It's called First Light and it's out on April 23rd. And it continues to follow Mia's very dark coming of age as she tries to, you know, vindicate her mother and discovers who she really is in some ways she didn't expect. And we will go to some new locations, follow her around. It's a little darker. It's a little more adult. Right now, it's my favorite thing I've ever written, and I hope I still feel that way about it a year from now.
Aww.
That's awesome.
I'm unafraid to say I like something sometimes.
Ugh, I can't wait to get there.
Yeah, but also just normalize writers loving what they're working on.
Yes.
You know, and being like, what I'm working on is awesome.
Yes.
Because I think especially women writers have a hard time saying that.
Yeah. It's not that it's not hard. There are days I'm working on this that feel very impossible. But at its core, I'm still so excited about it.
Well, we're excited about it.
Normalize liking things that you wrote.
Yes.
Yeah.
Normalize liking your work and liking other people's work. And mm-hmm. it's okay to just like something. And yeah. you don't even have to explain why.
Yeah. If absolutely. You don't like something, you don't have to say anything.
Exactly. Mind your own goddamn business and stay off Twitter. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't yuck someone's yum. Never.
Love that. All right. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @untitledfemale. You can connect with us there or email us at untitledfemaledrivenpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you'd like to hear us talk about. Bye.
Bye. Bye.